Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. I want to say, to start out with, I'm always thrilled to be talking to Naomi Dahlgren because she is thorough. She is absolutely to be trusted with all of her research, and she gives good recipes. So what else? We're going to be talking to her about a very exciting cuisine, actually. It's called Taste of Persia. And doesn't that evoke ideas of luxury?
It does. Just in case you're wondering where it is on the map, it's now called Iran.
Yeah.
Maybe enough said about that, but these recipes sound absolutely wonderful and delicious. And so we're pleased to bring it to you. Interesting enough, we're going to be staying roughly in the same region for the entire program anyway. But here's Naomi to kick us all off.
I'm going to attempt this. Naomi Dugan?
Excellent.
You are such an adventurer. I have your latest book in front of me, Taste of Persia, A Cook's Travels Through Armenia, Azerbaijan, Georgia, Iran, and Kurdistan. That is called what? As part of the world.
Well, I think of it as a Persian culinary region.
Okay.
And that's why the book's called Taste of Persia, because each of those regions, and actually sub-regions in each of those countries, have distinctive elements in their cuisine. But they all, all that region was part of the Persian Empire, intermittently as the Persian Empire ebbed and flowed. And there's a sort of cousinage between the cuisines in the same way as you can think of a Mediterranean culinary region. You know, you can tell Italian from Spanish, but on the other hand, you can recognize that they share some ingredients and, you know,
right.
a relationship.
Now, I was reading David Tamas did a brief introduction to your book. Not in your book, but I'm talking about in the New York Times. And he said that you open all of your books with a map.
Yes.
And I'm looking at the map here, which is it's a very large area, and it's a very important area. But the point of having the map is to show what?
Well, when I proposed the book to Anne Bramson, my editor, and she said, okay, it sounds a little complicated. And I said, well, yes, but actually I hope to make it less complicated. And then when I sent the manuscript in, she said, it's quite a complicated area. And I said, that's why we need a map, maybe two maps. So there are, in fact, two maps in the front of the book. I really want people to get situated. And, you know, the easiest thing when people are reading through the book, I want them to see, oh, I see, there's the sea coast. Oh, there's Georgia, and actually where the Sochi Olympics were was just off, you know, the tip of the Caucasus Mountains, right off the border of Georgia, and just to understand where things are. And I think it's hardest to understand where things are when we're in a part of the world where there isn't a big, you know, coast on the Atlantic or coast on the Pacific. It's sort of in the middle of the landmass of Asia. And so, yes, a map, absolutely. Anyway, I love maps. That's the other real reason.
Well, you're going to be talking a lot to Peter about maps because he has a master's in geography from Cambridge.
Well, there you are.
Actually,
my undergraduate degree is in geography.
Oh, good.
There you are.
That's wonderful. So I'm a master, so you're my slave.
There you go.
Draw me a map of Persia.
Yes, right, exactly.
Draw me a map of Persia freehand. Now, what I was going to say is that one of the things that makes it either easier or more complicated, depending on whether you're a historian or not, is that if you go 5 centuries B.C., this was all one empire.
Well, if you go 5 centuries B.C., we're then talking about the Assyrians, really. And then the Elamites, who were the precursors to the Persians, conquered the Assyrians and then built the empire, you know, Cyrus and then Darius the Great. The amazing thing is that we can talk about this at all and know about it at all because, of course, there was a literate culture, first of all. And second, we still have carved and built remnants of that culture, not just the palace and the ruins at Persepolis, Darius's capital that was sacked by Alexander the Great. I mean, imagine we're talking about this. But also that their graves are there, with marked and carved, and, you know, it's an extraordinary continuity, the history of the Persian Empire. And that's, I think, the thing that's so remarkable when you're in the region. Do you know, I don't know what your schooling was like, but when I went to high school in grade 11, we did sort of the ancient world. And at some point we got to, the Greek-Persian Wars. And I just never understood why would the Persians be there? Why were they fighting the Greeks? Because mostly the history was taught from a European point of view.
Right, exactly.
And it's only after traveling and, after reading, but also after traveling in Iran and seeing it from the Persian point of view, oh, I see, they were expanding westward, the Greeks were, expanding eastward, and what we now call Turkey was part of what was in dispute. But at the time, it made no sense. It was sort of like, why did these Persians arrive here, and why was there the battle of, Marathon and so on. So that's one of the things that I think our heads, we tend to start from, of course, where we're from. And it's really important, that's the other reason for the map, to move people's heads into another, to center them somewhere else on the globe, to see things from that point of view.
But when there was a Persian Empire, all these people were, if you like, citizens of a Persian Empire, but they were very different people. So an Iranian is very different than an Armenian, and an Armenian is very different than a Kurd, and so on and so forth. So, but yet they were an integrated empire way back when. Now they're not. Now you have these nationality groups.
She has this thing called gastro-nationalism that she talks about.
And that has to do with the fact that the people really are different. At least they think they're different.
No, they absolutely are different. I mean, they people are different, but we're in a different era. We had empires in those days of Persia, and now we have nation-states, but people still identify with their local valley, with their language, with their religion, with, the history they conceive of as the history of their forebears. And there are also discontinuities in that, so that, for example, at the time of Cyrus and Darius in the Persian Empire, the religion was Zoroastrianism. And then
I know about that.
Yeah, and then there was Christianity. There were Jews and Christians in Iran, as well as Zoroastrians, as time went forward. And then you have the Arab conquest. So that there's a sequence of, there's overlays of conquest by armies, but also by, religions, conquest, persuasion, whatever you want to call it. But there's the layers of, it's not just an erasure. Sometimes it's an erasure, but often it leaves layers of culture. So,
and part of your effort here is to, it's not just a straight cookbook. You want to convey the concept of the culture of the peoples, the complexity of these areas, as well as the flavors and what connects them to each other.
Well, exactly. And I want people to appreciate that, if you think about all the different alphabets, for example, even Armenians and Georgians have different alphabets. They're both Christian, different kinds of Christian. The Assyrians have another alphabet again, and they speak Aramaic, and they have several kinds of Christian. And then you have, several kinds of Muslim, and then there's the Yazidis who have their religion, which is different again. And then there's the Zoroastrians, and all of that, all of those ways of, people conceiving of themselves, part of the fabric that also informs the culinary fabric. And I just want people to hear, to get a sense of the richness, but also the complexity and the human scale of, we're all making food or thinking about food every day in some way or other. And that's a thing we can relate to in other places.
I was amazed, first of all, you did explain to me before we came on that it was perfectly safe for a woman to travel alone in this area because it really was dependent on the peoples as opposed to government policies or religious.
Right.
Yes. And then the second thing that I was amazed at is that you were invited into so many households, because that doesn't happen in many places of the world, really.
No, there's a real culture of hospitality. It's sort of a remarkable. Or if people are out somewhere picnicking, I'd be invited to join them. Or, you know, if you're on your own, yeah, there's an openness and a generosity, and it seems especially remarkable in a place, for example, in the Caucasus countries that have known, that have been part of the Soviet Union, were part of the Soviet Union for a long time, and have known various kinds of conflict and unhappiness. And yet there's this generosity. It's really culturally distinct thing. It's really amazing.
Wouldn't happen if you're walking down Yonge Street, would it?
Not usually. I mean, I know some people who have open doors and are very generous, but it's really, yes, it's not what it would be surprising. It would be more surprising. And so it was incredible. And the trick, of course, is to figure out how to be relaxed and at ease with people being generous with you when you actually don't have any way of reciprocating.
And how did you communicate?
With, you know, gesture. I mean, with body, you know.
Okay.
And some language. I mean, you have some words of politeness, and I have kitchen words in various languages. And then a lot of people have English, or some English, or a little bit of English. In Azerbaijan, Armenia, sometimes a little bit of Russian helped. I have only a little bit of Russian. And, you know, like that. But it's human that we communicate with each other, and so there's a lot of goodwill required, and there is a lot of goodwill.
Now, there's not a singular dish or culinary style for the region. You say that what was the term I just used before?
Gastronationalism.
Yeah, gastronationalism is strong, but that there are no boundaries in culinary boundaries.
Well, it's more, I think, if you think about it, gastronationalism is especially apparent in places which have had to work hard to establish their identity. So this gastronationalism, I wouldn't say, is, you know, I mean, it's not so much an issue in somewhere like Iran, which has been, you know, Persian culture has been there for a long time. They don't have anything to defend anyone. They're just proud of who they are and what they are. But if you Georgian, Armenian, Azeri, and you were, you know, looped into the Soviet Union for a long time and have had for a long time to sort of have your elbows out to maintain your identity, then you're going to have all sorts of issues around markers that say, you're going to say, that's ours. No, we started that. Mm-hmm. No, the Turks say it's theirs, but it's ours. You know, that kind of thing. It's really a big deal. But it's sort of very understandable.
Well, if you said, before I read your book, if you said Persian cuisine to me, I would say pomegranate, walnut,
and couscous.
I don't know that I'd say
couscous. No, you wouldn't say couscous?
And I guess I would fall into the various spices because there's so many spices available in these cuisines. Did you find anything unusual, or was it pretty like what we envision as the traditions, the culinary traditions, though?
Well, I think you could say that the through lines or the consistent ingredients, though, then they're worked with differently in the region are, yes, things like pomegranate molasses, sort of a tart sweet. So the use of tart fruits in savory dishes, the use of fruit generally in savory dishes, like apricots, dried apricots, for example.
Right.
Then the use of fresh herbs, used fresh, put on the table in a pile, and also cooked into dishes to give a layering, subtle layerings of flavor. Use of a lot of greens.
Yeah, the herb plate is amazing.
Yeah, the herb plate is incredible. And the use of walnuts in northern Iran and in the Caucasus, and then further south you have pistachios.
Oh, yeah, the pistachios is another one.
But that's further south, and you wouldn't run into them so much in the Caucasus. And so, because there is a, you know, there's southern Iran is quite different from, I mean, you're grading into hotter climate, whereas in northern Iran and the Caucasus, it's very similar, and Kurdistan, they really have a very similar climate. So you have, it's really very, not very meat-based to trade, and you can have meat kebabs and so on, but actually most of the cuisine is other, and flatbreads, of course, are the first thing.
Oh, yes, you.
That are everywhere. There's flatbreads everywhere. Some of them, you know, the cheese-filled breads in Georgia called khachapuri, but also just straight flatbreads, but very distinctive, locally different versions of flatbread. And then rice, except for in Georgia. So rice is a very big deal in Iran and also in Azerbaijan and, and Kurdistan. And so, you know, those are kind of your elements. So it's very fresh. And actually, I was at a dinner with friends last night. A bunch of people did a kind of potluck out of the book, out of Taste of Persia.
Oh, that's a great idea.
It was very fun. And so they figured out, everybody figured out what they were making. And there were 12 of us around the table. And at the end of the meal, several people said, but you know what's so interesting? I don't feel burdened by heavy richness. And this has been so light. There's been, you know, just the fresh herbs and the tart fruits and stuff. It's really a variety of tastes, but also a really sort of easy on the body. And I think that's another thing to think about. And a lot of dishes that are don't have meat at all, and that's because that's part of that's frugality. You can add a little meat if you want to, but you don't need to.
Well, that's
so they stand on their own,
that.
You know.
Yeah.
And also because of fasting traditions, because in the Eastern Rite churches, so that's the Armenians and the Georgians and the Assyrians, when you fast for example, for Easter in Lent, it's about giving up all animal products entirely. So, I mean, there's a couple of days where they eat fish, but basically otherwise. So there's all these dishes that have no dairy and no meat either, and yet there's no sense of deprivation. They make brilliant use of, you know, eggplants and mushrooms and, you know, it's just because it's a sustainable thing that people have been doing for centuries. It's not kind of a last-minute invention. Oh, how can I leave the meat out of this dish? You know, it's really, this is how people have been eating for a long, long time.
Now, we recently read a book about Samarkand. In fact, that was the title of the book.
Yep.
And it was all about the spice route which traversed this area. Now, how much of that is reflected in the cuisine that you include?
Well, I don't know that I particularly sign on to that spice route notion along the,
okay.
You know, the Silk Road. I know, but it's interesting because saffron, for example, grows in Kashmir in India, and it also, but the biggest producer of saffron right now is Iran, and it grows along the border with Afghanistan. So that sort of eastern part of Iran and Afghanistan and then into sort of Uzbekistan where Samarkand is and Turkmenistan, that's all like sort of heartland Central Asia. And the spices used in, it's not very spice-laden cuisine. This is not like the Indian subcontinent. There's not loads and loads of, you know, cloves and cinnamon. I mean, there's some fenugreek, sure, but that grows there. Cinnamon comes in, but in Iran, mostly things come in from by sea to southern Iran. Southern Iran gives on the Indian Ocean. And so, yes, I'm sure there was a trade in spices because they're light and they're valuable. But it's really more, it's not as, what's the word, it's not as exotic as people are making it sound. It's quite normal. People have been working with what they have locally a lot more than spending money on exotica from the South Seas, if I can put it that way. And so what you have instead is this use of the fresh herbs. I think that comes from using what you have locally, using fruits, because there's an enormous amount of fruit that grows in the Caucasus region in northern Iran. And that's really the heart of the cuisine. And the nuts as well, that's all local.
Yeah, it's funny. Everybody forgets that Georgia is mostly mountains. And as a result, the weather is a whole lot cooler.
Well, yes, but they also have valleys. And in the valleys, there's vines growing, and it's a very diverse climate, but with rich soil in the valley bottoms, and the Black Sea is a moderating influence. So, you know, you have, it's hard to generalize because it's so varied, actually.
Well, we can generalize is that people with sweet tooth would do well there.
Yes.
And I mean, the restraint you're describing in all other ways really doesn't travel into the dessert segment, because I've made some of those desserts.
Yeah, no, they're sweet, but they're not eaten as desserts.
No,
they're not. So that's the thing to keep in mind, that people are eating them as a sweet, as a hit, but not sort of loading it on at the end of a meal, if you know what I mean.
Right, yeah.
And that's the interesting thing. And they're not actually that sweet. They're not as sort of sweet as the... as I would say, as the baklavas of the Eastern Mediterranean,
okay.
You know, honey syrup drenched. But the idea is that they should be a hit, a small bite, and not sort of a huge piece of Black Forest cake, so to speak.
Well, Naomi Duguid, I must say, this Taste of Persia, readers and listeners, if you read this book, you're going to learn so much. Just picking it up, I learned so much. I couldn't even believe it, Naomi.
Well, I'm so glad, and I hope that you've enjoyed and will enjoy cooking from it.
Right. Yeah, I mean, some of these things are really kind of basic.
They're very simple. That's the thing that's so interesting. It's very accessible, and that's what happened at that feast last night. People said, oh, there's a bunch of these things that are going to turn into my normal. I really love this fish salad. Ooh, I'm going to make this yogurt soup again. That was so simple. I thought it was going to be hard, and it was easy.
Yeah,
and that was, of course, music to my ears. I'm happy about that.
Yeah, well, I think one of those yogurt soups would be something I'll make, too.
Yeah, delicious.
Anyhow, very good job, Naomi. And
thank you so much.
When are you off to your next adventure?
I don't know what my next project is. I am going to there's a festival of arts and literature in Goa on the west coast of India.
I've been dying to go to Goa.
And it's, that's Festival of Arts and Literature, Goa Arts and Literature Festival, GALF, is on the weekend of the, 10th, 11th, 12th. And I'm going, and I'm so excited. It's going to be so enriching
wonderful.
And interesting.
Well, that's exciting.
It sure is.
Say hello to Toronto for us.
We'll do that.
We usually cover Taste of Toronto.
Uh-huh. Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
And perhaps we'll meet.
It's such a cosmopolitan city. I can see you're well prepped for your worldwide travels.
For sure.
Naomi, thank you for talking to us.
A pleasure speaking with you.
I was going to say don't go ahead, but what I really meant was don't go away, because we'll be right back after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Now, we get to sample a lot of different products, but this next one, I really love this. It's Soom Foods Tahini, and we have it the regular, and we have it in chocolate, and I like both of them, and we're going to be talking to Amy Zeitelman.
We just spoon it right out of the jar.
Yeah, I know. It's terrible. It's disgusting.
Forget about putting it with something else. Forget about cooking with it. It just tastes so delicious.
Oh, it's wonderful.
And it's a really interesting story of...
Yeah, Amy and her two sisters are entrepreneurs who discovered this, and she's going to tell us all about it. Well, we're going to be talking to one of a trio of food producer entrepreneurs, Amy Zeitelman. You are in the States, and I guess your two sisters, one is in Israel and one is in the States. Tell me, I was just caught up by the image of tahini, Soom Foods tahini, and I realized I really didn't know anything about tahini, and... Tell us, what exactly is tahini besides being an ingredient in hummus?
That's a really great question, and it was actually those questions during our discovery process that really inspired us to start this business. But tahini is a sesame paste. It's made from roasted and pressed sesame seeds, and similar to coffee or wine or olive oil, a product or an ingredient that only uses one produce in it, the quality and the type of sesame seed that it's made from really impacts the flavor profile, consistency, and things like that. So Soom tahini is pressed from sesame seeds from Ethiopia of the white humera variety. But tahini, yes, they're from the northwest region of Ethiopia.
Well, now hold on a second, Amy. Let's go back. Let's go back a step.
Great.
What's a sesame?
Is it
a plant? Is it a tree?
Great question.
Okay.
It is a plant, actually. It's similar to a stalk like wheat, and so it's a long, thick stalk that grows actually in huge fields, similar to a wheat field, and it has a beautiful white flower at the top. So it's really not a familiar or a popular plant because sesame doesn't really grow in the States. But at the top of these stalks, pods grow. They actually kind of look like okra, so you can imagine them being green and like kind of fuzzy-ish. And the sesame seeds grow in those pods.
Okay,
and the story goes that, well, when the sesame seeds are ready to be harvested, those pods would kind of pop open. And that's where the saying open sesame might come from.
Oh, really? No kidding. That's cute. That's amazing.
Yeah.
So it wasn't really Aladdin and his 40 thieves or whatever it was at all. It was some.
You know, the trap of sesame through the spice trade, I'm sure lots of different sayings influenced each other through the different regions where the spices and the seeds were traded.
Now, are sesame and Benny seeds the same thing?
I believe they're of the same variety, but I think it's a different type of seed in the same family. But I'm not well versed on Benny seeds, but they do grow in the southern states. And
they come from Africa, though. Yeah.
They come from Africa, but there are some growing in the southern states. And we've seen people press that into tahini as well, especially some of these chefs in the South that want to incorporate local produce.
And the South you're referring to here is the South of the United States. Got it.
Correct.
Now, were you doing anything having to do with food production before this revelation?
Oh, gosh, no, actually. I was just a senior in college when we had the idea to see if we could start a tahini business. My oldest sister studied entrepreneurial management, so she had a business degree.
Uh-huh.
And Jackie, my middle sister that lives in Israel, she was dating Omri, who is now her husband, and he was in the tahini industry in Israel. So we never had any experience in food production, sales, or distribution, but we do come from a long line of entrepreneurs. So the idea of starting a business wasn't entirely foreign to us.
No. So, but you don't use Israeli sesame seeds. I mean, how did you hit on the African?
Well, what's interesting is even though tahini is such an important and integral ingredient in Israeli and Middle Eastern cuisine, sesame seeds don't grow in the Middle East. A few grow in Turkey, actually, but the largest producer is India. China's up there, and then, of course, Africa, Sudan, and Ethiopia. But the way that tahini or sesame seeds reached that region was through the spice trade. And there are even quotes from when Queen Sheba visited King Solomon that sesame was one of the gifts that she brought. So it became a very familiar product, but it doesn't grow in Israel.
I see. Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm.
Now, most people would recognize hummus, of course. But now, do you also use tahini in halva?
Yes.
Aha.
Exactly.
I knew there was something.
So tahini, exactly, is one of the main ingredients in halva. They stir in and cook tahini with lots of sugars and other kinds of emulsifiers and roots to make that halva texture. But that's exactly, you know, the point. And what's amazing about good tahini is it is good for so much more than hummus. When we were first introduced to good tahini back in 2011, tahini is a condiment or a topping on frozen yogurt bars in Israel. And it's always an option of something that you can add to a smoothie, for instance, in Israel. And they really embraced tahini as a sweet ingredient, which was something that was so foreign to us because we were only familiar with tahini in terms of hummus and salad dressings and more of the savory application of the product.
Now, is there kind of a biblical reason why? I mean, did Joseph and his coat of many colors bring it across the Red Sea when it parted? Or, I mean,
that's a great question. The only biblical reference I know is with Queen of Sheba and King Solomon.
Got it, okay.
But I think it's because they're also so much closer to the East, which incorporates sesame and a lot into their cuisine because of the health benefits.
So it has a lot of health benefits, huh?
Yes. It's a great source of fat, and it's high in calcium and iron. 2 tablespoons has 7 grams of protein. And I think because the Middle East is between Africa and, of course, Asia, that it became a much more popular ingredient in their cuisine than us all the way over here in the Western Hemisphere.
So it's okay that I'm eating this out of the jar by the teaspoonfuls, huh?
Correct. We highly encourage that. We'll sneak a spoonful of it maybe before we exercise And we'll mix it with a little bit of honey to sweeten it up and spread it on toast. But it makes us feel good to incorporate tahini into our diet. And that's when we really got excited for the opportunity to introduce a delicious, nutritious, and versatile product to the States.
Now, we got regular tahini and we got chocolate tahini. Are there other flavors?
Not yet, but it's something that we are working on. The chocolate is pretty popular.
Wonderful.
If you got the chance to try it, thank you.
Oh, I just ate it with a big spoon today.
Well, I looked at your website. You seem to have quite a number of different jars.
Correct. We have a few different sizes, and that's
because we service both
the retail industry, but we primarily service the food service industry. So a lot of the sizes are an option that we sell to chefs and restaurants across the country. But we wanted to make the slightly larger format available to at-home cooks in case they wanted more tahini.
So I didn't really read the labels closely, so that's the difference.
Now, correct.
The amazing thing, and it's amazing on both sides, I guess, amazing for you that you were able to get signed up with Amazon.com. But even more amazing, I guess, is the fact that Amazon.com decided tahini was something that they wanted to carry.
Isn't that amazing? I mean, the evolution and the interest in tahini over the past 4 or 5 years has been unbelievable. But that's really been influenced, you know, not by us, but by the restaurant industry. Because Mediterranean and Middle Eastern cuisine has become more popular, and these chefs are sharing their recipes, and these, you know, these flavors and ingredients are becoming more familiar, the demand for tahini has just increased more than we ever could have imagined in the past few years.
So you just kind of got lucky, huh?
We got lucky. You know what? We had a hypothesis, but we got lucky that we were right.
There we go. You had a hypotenuse as well.
an educated guess, I guess, I should say.
Explain what the difference is from the different seeds. Is it like a terroir with wine or what?
Correct. That's exactly the way I explain it. It's like terroir with wine. So the region, you know, factors include elevation and the type of soil and how much water they get and the qualities of the soil. And so, yeah, you know, exactly like wine, the same variety of seed, white humera, could grow in different regions and produce different flavor profiles and qualities depending on where it grows.
So
it's amazing.
Has it been picked up for you said it was cultivation in the southern United States, but has it caught on in places like Australia where they seem to be able to grow just about anything?
You know, I don't know if they're growing sesame seeds in Australia, but yes, when we were first starting our market research on the United States and the opportunity for tahini here, most of the really amazing bloggers and people that understood the versatility of tahini for savory and sweet I was finding on social media were out of Australia. They are so progressive with their ingredients and with the products, and it seems, I mean, there are so many people working with tahini in Australia. It's amazing.
They were the first ones to promote Africa, actually, too. We interviewed somebody who found a commercial production method for Africa, which is, you know, burnt green
wheat. That's why I asked the question. But I suspect in Australia it probably has to do with the fact that there is a fairly substantial population of migrants from the Mediterranean countries all the way from Israel to Greece in particular. Now, is tahini big in Greece and Turkey?
Tahini is really, what's interesting about Greece and something that I'm still learning about is tahini is a popular export. It's a popular ingredient. You see a lot of Greek tahinis available on the market, but I don't find it incorporated into Greek cuisine much as Middle Eastern cuisine.
No, they seem happy to stop at hummus.
Exactly. And so it is so interesting, you know, as we were learning about the industry, Greece was such an important factor in production and branding and things like that. But in terms of me and where I eat at Greek restaurants, I don't see it incorporated into menus, you know, in a lot of different ways.
No, I mean, I used to have a Greek restaurant in Philadelphia, and we didn't have any. Now, where do you produce this? You get the seeds from Ethiopia, then where do you produce this?
We contract with a manufacturer in Israel because my sister and her husband still live there. You know, we didn't really have the resources to build our own factory. So we teamed up with some really high-quality manufacturers in Israel that were willing to use our seeds and help us manufacture the product and fill our product in Israel.
And you managed to cope with the USDA?
Yes. Luckily, they're already FDA certified, and which is wonderful.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
One of the great things is that there's fair trade, and so it's actually very easy, and we're not taxed very much importing from Israel. And so we've learned a lot about, you know, the logistics and what it really entails to import a product. And so far, so good. But they're checked regularly by the USDA and FDA.
Oh, I bet. I mean, this
no
is a real nightmare, yeah. And you seem to care a lot about the appearance, your marketing appearance as well, right?
Thank you, yes.
I mean, we were real impressed with how you packaged everything.
I appreciate that, and it was something that we realized, you know, when we discovered, or, you know, we didn't invent or discover tahini, but when we were introduced to it 5 years ago, and we looked and we really, you know, researched the American market, we saw that most tahinis available were branded in a very ethnic way or a very kind of dated way.
Yes.
And one of the things that we wanted to accomplish wanted tahini to be more familiar to the American market.
Right.
How can we explain to people that it's more like a mix between an olive oil and a peanut butter? And we really knew that we had to convey that through our look and our label to make it more comfortable as an American, or eventually we hope an American staple, and pull it away from the fact that it's an ethnic or foreign ingredient.
You know, if somebody wants to buy your brand of tahini, can they do that through your website?
Yes, sumfoods.com is our website, and we sell directly through there. We also sell on Amazon, of course, and some really great retailers online and a few stores across the country.
Amy, I think that you should be writing a cookbook about, I'm sure you've researched this, all the different applications of this as an ingredient.
Yes, and you know what? Michael Salmanov in his Zahav cookbook has a whole chapter on tahini, and it's amazing. You know, he really embraced that versatility.
Michael Salmanov, does he?
We've interviewed him. Have you seen his cookbook?
Yeah, we I think the latest one we interviewed about.
We talked to him about
amazing.
We talked to him about it on the air.
Oh, awesome. Yeah, so he has a whole chapter on tahini, and exactly, he really did. But my sisters and I aren't exactly culinarily inclined. We love the product, and we love it for its really simple uses, like drizzling it on Greek yogurt or putting it into a smoothie, maybe a stir-fry sauce. But we'll leave, you know, the recipe development to the experts.
There you go. And you
well
like,
said.
And you like to spoon it out of the jar.
And we just eat it straight from the jar, so we're really useless.
I do that too with honey and things like that.
Yeah.
I'm
going to have to get some of that chocolate tahini right after lunch.
It's good. It's like real chocolate.
We call the chocolate tahini our guiltless indulgence. Enjoy.
Well, it's been such a pleasure to talk to you, Amy. Good luck to you and your sisters.
I suspect
that you're going to become tahini billionaires.
Maybe one day. I really appreciate it. And thank you so, so much for the opportunity to talk.
Well, it's been a pleasure, Amy. Thank you.
Same here.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Right on track in this wonderful region of the world. Next up, we've got John Gregory Smith, that's a hyphen, Gregory hyphen Smith, and his book, Turkish Delights, which also conjures up opulence. And
yeah, and it's just right across the border from where we started
today's
program. So I feel like we've come around in circles today. We do that frequently, I guess.
I guess so.
Sort of lose track of where we're going. But we haven't lost track of where we're going, because Turkish Delights is really an astounding achievement in information about a part of the world that we don't know very well. Lots of other people know well, we don't, so we're glad to have the chance to talk about it with John.
I love Turkish food. I love the whole thing about it. I mean, I like the civilization around it, about eating together. We're talking to John Gregory Smith, that's hyphenated. And, John, you've spent a great deal of time in Turkey, one end to the other, for a lot of years. Your father is Turkish, and your partner is Turkish. And you also...
Now, Gregory Smith, that's a fine old Turkish name.
do you know what? My dad's not actually Turkish, but his father was in the Navy and was the naval attaché in Ankara for many years. So when my dad was growing up, his mum and dad and sister were living there full time. But my dad was a little bit older and was at school in Scotland. So he used to have to travel in the holidays just before planes, and he would get the train down to Portsmouth and then get the boat over to Turkey for his holidays.
Uh-huh.
And we've got these wicked old black and white pictures of them on holiday, various places around Turkey. So that was sort of my intro was through him.
The opening map is really very useful because you show geographically how Turkey's laid out, and it is such a diverse country in terms of all kinds of things, and particularly culinarily diverse.
Sure.
And you
it's
show
massive as well.
And what? And language too.
I think that's one of the nice things about it. You know, it's such a huge country, and you've got, you know, different climates and different, like, regional landscapes, different influences. You were just saying, you know, the history as well. Everyone's been through Turkey and left a little stamp. So food-wise, it's really bonkers. It's a really interesting place to be.
Yeah, well, I said before we actually started the interview that my background is Sicilian, and it was the same situation. It's a corridor country, and everybody went through there and left a bit. So, the people absorbed all these different cultural influences.
Now, here's a thought on top of that, though. I mean, I'm not contradicting what you're saying, but in fact, Turkey was the heart of the Ottoman Empire, which controlled more of the world than the Roman Empire did.
Yes.
Yeah.
For hundreds and hundreds of years, including finishing up at the doorstep of cities in Greece and places like Vienna and Budapest.
No, it's amazing, right? And they've still got that kind of hangover from the food of that really, really opulent, you know, really opulent dishes, really rich meat dishes and kebabs and rices spiced with loads of spices and nuts and things like that. It's like a real hangover from that time.
Now, you do give some attention to the regional differences. I mean, some of them are very obvious because you have all that coastline, and you certainly have a predominance of seafood in those areas, and you have the internal sections, the plains and so forth. But you find certain consistent strains throughout the country. What are those?
Yes. So there are set dishes that they pretty much will cook all across the country, or that you can go and get in restaurants. So, for example, you'll get pide, which is like a sort of, it's like a Turkish pizza, or lahmacun, which is like a round, again, like a Turkish pizza. The pide is more like boat shape, and you'll be able to get those pretty much across the entire country. You know, that's like their kind of fast food, take-up food.
Mm-hmm.
Kebabs as well, which are originally from the east part of Turkey, and that's where still you get, I think you get the best, but you'll get kebab across the whole country, and the meze as well. So when Turks eat out, they will start with really lovely kind of cold meze salads, so like lovely yogurt dip, aubergine dips, roasted peppers and things like that. And again, you tend to get those throughout the country as well. But the bits that really change is the home cooking and the fish as well.
Well, I've already earmarked some salads that I'm going to try from there, and a number of aubergine recipes.
Yes, they do aubergines really well. And I think also I'm a bit biased because I really love aubergine. I think it's amazing.
Yeah, now, Peter has earmarked something here. Why did I not know this?
Well, there's a fine old British dish on the menu called liver and onions. I wonder who taught
you. Oh, yeah. That's like, it sounds really British, but it's not. It's like a really classic meze dish. And they just pan fry the liver in a bit of butter with some pul biber, which is like a smoked chili flake, a little bit of salt, lemon juice. It's just very simple flavors, but you know, you're relying on the best ingredients and you just sort of chow through that with some delicious bread, and it's a really lovely starter.
Now, I didn't know that Turkey, on the culinary scene, for Turkey, the most important meal was breakfast. I mean, how did they manage to spend so much time and energy on breakfast?
That I don't know, but I'm glad they did, because their breakfasts are really, really good. And it's a really big deal. So you have like, it's almost like you sort of ease into breakfast. So you start with a lovely cup of tea. So they do like the black tea, which is sort of served quite, not too strong. Some people like it quite strong, but you get your cup of black tea. You have eggs. Your eggs might be with a sort of a fried sausage called sucuk.
Yeah.
Or you might get a dish called menemen, which is like a sort of scrambled, almost like a kind of Mexican egg, you know, scrambled with peppers and tomatoes. And then they'll have this whole spread of like olives, cucumber, parsley, tomatoes, different cheeses, so soft cheeses, hard cheeses, lovely, lovely soft fresh bread, honeys, maybe things like fig jams. And it just all, you get this just beautiful, vibrant, colourful spread laid out. And just, you very slowly make your way through it. They don't overeat, actually. Turks are not like Brits or Americans. We, you know, when we eat, we like to eat a lot. They'll eat often little, but just wonderful, like really wonderful. And then you finish up with loads of, and finish up fresh coffee and fruit. It's just fab.
And this is called, what's called a full Turkish, right?
A full Turkish, mate. Yeah, you got it.
But there's no black pudding and no baked beans.
No, it's a little bit more refined than that.
Tomatoes.
Yeah.
Yeah, good, they're good. Really gorgeous fresh tomatoes, yeah.
Now,
but it's so healthy, so healthy.
Well, you know, all the Mediterranean stuff is healthy, they say, so. I didn't see any preserved lemons in your recipes.
They don't really use it at all. That's more, that's more like North African or, a bit more Middle Eastern. They don't really use that as an ingredient.
Oh, that's interesting, yeah.
Mm.
I would think they would. They do use a lot of lemons though, huh?
Masses of lemon. Like lemon on everything. Like, if you go to a kebab shop and you eat kebab, you'll be given, you know, like massive wedges of lemon to go on everything. They really love that sort of sour flavour. So, yeah, lemons are really predominant. And because of the climate, they grow beautiful, big, gorgeous lemons everywhere. They're quite sweet in some places.
See, that's like Sicily, too. I mean, they look like oranges. They're that big.
Yeah. Do you know what I mean? And they're sort of almost, they're so fragrant as well. They're lovely.
Right. And, of course, I mean, I usually keep in season a bowl of pomegranate seeds just sitting in the refrigerator when we want a snack.
Oh. Gorgeous, right?
Yeah, you have a lot of... Oh, I forgot to tell you, I took your advice and I had tea with saffron in it this morning.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, it was good.
What? Yeah?
It's expensive, though. I mean, I can't have that every day.
No.
Did you find saffron? Yeah. Do we still have saffron?
We have saffron, yeah. So I just put it in my green tea.
Because it's on the board that says we need to get some more, so you must have been hiding it.
I don't think...
Have you guys started having turmeric tea?
Oh, yeah, we have that. We use a lot of turmeric, lots of it.
Yeah. But that's sort of like so in right now.
Yeah, we used it before it was so in, but.
Yeah, we discovered that you could buy it fresh just a few months ago.
Oh, well, you couldn't buy it fresh in the supermarket until.
But now you can. There's a chain over here called Whole Foods. There's an expensive one on Kensington High Street. And you can buy it. It's only a mere $9 a pound.
Wow. Fortunately, I mean, for a treat, though, it's worth it because the colour and the flavour of the fresh is incredible. Like, going off piece from Turkey, but there's some really fab, like, Indian curries where, in the sort of South Indian, where when the flavour of the turmeric hits the coconut milk and the curry leaves, you know, wow, it's worth the extra money every now and then.
Peter puts it in his pork stew, and he makes a special drink called a turmertini.
Ah, wicked! Can I come over and have one?
Yeah, it's very attractive.
The best thing about it is find the best craft gin you can find.
And yeah.
All you need is a few slices of fresh turmeric and crushed ice, and you're done.
You've got a party for one right there.
You have your two martini.
you cook as well, then, I mean, because these recipes, you say, are for the home cook and not restaurant. Yeah. And you yourself have tested all these recipes.
Yeah, so I mean, the way I work up my books is I'll go away and I will just get as lost as I can in the country that I'm going to and get access to local homes. So hanging out with local people in different regions, because obviously the food changes so much regionally, try and get there at different seasons as well, because the seasonality is massive, you know, in countries like that where they don't eat processed food. And just try and submerge myself and really get to grips with what's going on, you know, with home food culture, which is the kind of recipes that are passed down from one generation to the next. And then I'll be taking hundreds of notes and pictures as I'm going along and trying to understand, you know, little tips and techniques and why things are done, because it's the home cook that just, you know, they know it best. You do this because this is, you know, this is how it's always been done, and that's what's made it taste, you know, wonderful. And then I come back home. And I work up all my recipes into like a big flat plan, so like a layout of the book in terms of chapters and what I think might fit where and when. And then I'll develop them all. So literally rework them up in the kitchen, trying to use as much as I can ingredients that we can get in England and America, because it's quite annoying when you get a recipe and you can't buy any ingredients.
Now, do you take your own pictures?
Some of them, I don't do the food photography. I've got an amazing team in London who do that for me, but I did some of the travel pictures in this book, which is brilliant, because I'm not a professional photographer, but I'm quite nerdy with my camera, put it that way. And I really love taking pictures, so it, you know, it's nice to be able to pop a few in there.
How do you get these, what do you call them? I mean, home cooks to invite you into their kitchens. I mean, do you speak the language or their languages?
No. I'm terrible at languages. I never paid attention in school, and it just, languages do not work in my head.
I know.
Languages and math, I can't do. But in Turkey, I was with either, they speak really good English in most places, and then if we were in really, really rural places, I would either be with someone who could help translating, and then the few times that I wasn't, they would know that I was there for a reason, and we would just muddle through with like Google Translator and sign language and seeing things. As long as in terms of recipes, as long as I see what's going on, I kind of get it. Obviously you'll miss the lovely detail about why things are there. So, you know, I always try and have a translator as much as I can, because that's where you get like the really good stuff. But it does, every time I do a trip, I've just come back, I'm doing a new book in Morocco, and I just come back from a month in Morocco, and I was like, right, that's it, I'm going to learn French for when I next go out there. And I tried for like 10 minutes to learn French, and I was like, it's not going to happen. So it's just sort of muddling through.
Do you know Murad, has a restaurant in San Francisco? He's from Morocco. He's fabulous. I love him.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I use a lot of his recipes. But my dream job was, was it the woman from in charge of the test kitchen at, was it Williams-Sonoma?
Williams-Sonoma, yes.
She got to go with Murad to his home country, Morocco.
Wow.
And
do you know?
Go ahead.
Do you know which bit he's from?
No, I don't remember. Just do Murad. What's his last name?
I don't know that either.
This restaurant's very well known, and he's a brilliant guy. So.
Oh, nice.
You'd like him, actually.
If you type in Murad and restaurant in San Francisco, he'll come up for sure.
Oh, yeah.
If you have any trouble, just shoot us an email, and
cool.
And we'll give you his contact information.
So, cool.
Yeah, and you use, I mean, Turkish cuisine includes a lot of smoked ingredients. Why is that?
They really love a smoky flavor. So I think a lot of it comes from charcoal cooking, like cooking over charcoal. Mm-hmm. So like the traditional way to cook everything would have been over fire. So even if you're cooking something in a pot over fire, it's going to absorb that smoke. And they're really into grilled meats. And the way they cook a grilled meat is instead of, you know, like we cook a barbecue.
Yes.
You'll put your coals down, then you'll put like a grate over the top, and we put our meats on the grate. They will just have the open pit, and then they'll put skewers across, and it seems to absorb even more flavour. And that for them, that smokiness is really, really important. So when they make different things, like anything from bread to stews, they'll inject that smoky flavour into it. So it might be that some of the ingredients are cooked over coal first of all, and then added, or they'll use a smoked chili pepper called pulbiba, which I talked about earlier, or they'll use this amazing ingredient. You know, like we have tomato puree,
yes,
or like a tomato paste that we'll use in stews. They have the same thing, but they also have a version that's made with peppers. So it's really, really intense and smoky. And again, it just adds that hit of flavor that they seem to be so passionate about into their food.
Tell me about these peppers. I didn't know anything about. What is a Turkish pepper?
So a Turkish pepper, so they've got like lots of different peppers that, you know, if we get peppers, say, from our supermarket, we'll tend to get like a red salad pepper or a green pepper or a yellow pepper.
Yeah.
And then they all sort of, you know, they've got a nice, slightly sweet flavour, and you can cook with them or eat them in a salad. But the green ones, I don't know about in America, the green ones in England tend to be a little bit bitter. In Turkey, they have these really cute little green peppers that are so sweet, really beautifully sweet, and they'll use them to make a thing called dolma. So they'll stuff them with rice and then cook them in stock. And that's a really sort of standard dish, actually. The other peppers they have look like chilies, like long green chilies, but they've got a very, very mild heat and a beautiful sweet flavour. And they use these green Turkish peppers in lots of cooking. So particularly the breakfast dish menemen, they put them in, or any of the sakkavama, which is like a lamb stew. They use that as a base, but it's got a really, really lovely mild sweet flavour that's just wonderful.
Now, on the page next to the liver and onions recipe was another one that caught my attention because it had okra in it.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah.
Now, is okra native to Turkey?
Yeah, again, I've not really ever sort of thought about Turkey and okra. I would more think of okra and Indian food. But, yeah, they grow it, and they use it in different dishes there as well. It's a very regional, very seasonal product.
Okay.
So, you know, when it's in season, they'll have it in the market and everyone will go off and cook with it.
Sounds exactly like the United States.
Yeah.
Oh, and hence pointing at herself. She has the page open at chapter 9, desserts.
Yeah. You say the Turkish have a sweet tooth and, oh, wow, their sweets special. Tell us about your dessert section.
So the Turks bloody love sweet food. They really love it. So from there, you can just see from the way they drink tea and coffee, even, you know, the amount of sugar that they
drink, right.
Crazy. And then they're sort of like national, sort of, you know, their version of afternoon tea is baklava, which is a really wonderful, like, layers of pastries stuffed with really delicious fresh nuts that are all grafted up. So things like pistachios and almonds, and then covered in a sugar syrup and baked. So it gets really crispy on the top and very moist in the middle, and you have a little square of it. And it's sort of, it's so sweet it makes your teeth tingle a little bit. But it's a really big deal in Turkey. And then their sort of puddings, they don't have loads and loads of puddings, but what they do have, they really love. And what I noticed from the home cooks is, you wouldn't make baklava, you'd eat it out. But
well,
the home
I just
cooks
read
will.
That, and, you know, I mean, I have made baklava at home, and it's like Chinese water torture.
Yeah, it's not, it's a long process. Sorry, the time differences.
John, no, I was joking, I was saying it was a balaklava.
But I just got it.
which was invented fairly close by.
Yeah, well,
right.
These look good. Your baklava, the honey baklava that you have in your book, the photograph looks, well, I love baklava,
yes,
by the way.
Yeah, that's a really,
and I don't have a sweet tooth, but I love baklava. I don't know why. You just need a little bite of it, and that's all you need.
for this one, we was really strange. We were driving across the center of Turkey, and they've got some amazing lakes in the center, like really massive, very beautiful, like freshwater lakes that are sort of reminded me of something more like New Zealand. I mean, it really gorgeous, gorgeous scenery. And we stopped at this tiny cafe in the middle of nowhere, in this little tiny village, and this amazing woman came out in her, like, massive fake Prada sunglasses, and she owned this cafe. So she was like, come in, and was chatting to us, and I was saying, like, oh, you know, I'm a chef, and I'm here to learn about the cuisine. You know, what do you like to cook? And she was saying, oh, our cafe's famous for this and famous for that. And I was like, well, that's great, but what do you cook? And she was like, well, I cook okra stew, weirdly, which is the one that you'd seen, this beef and okra stew, which she made. And then she went, oh, and I cook baklava. And I was like, oh, my God, I can't believe you make it from scratch. And she was like, no, I don't. I've got this trick. And that's this recipe here, which essentially, instead of doing the millions of layers, it's just rolling it. And by rolling it, you create sort of fake layers. And it was just so clever. And then instead of all the sugar syrup, it was a honey. And you know, it works just as well.
Well, that's good to know.
Well, when Anne makes it, she buys flaky pastry.
I mean, I would as well. Who's got time really to make filet pastry? Life is too short.
Yes, this is true.
Well, life's too short to not stop this conversation and start cooking something Turkish.
That's a great book, John, and congratulations and much success.
Thank you very much, guys.
And so we're looking forward to the next book, which is Moroccan, huh?
Yes, next year.
Okay. Well, I would welcome another Moroccan. I love Moroccan food as well.
It's already, like, taking shape, and I can tell you now, Anne, it's looking completely beautiful. It's very different from this book. It's very modern. But the recipes are similar style in that I've basically spent time in the middle of nowhere in different parts of Morocco. I went to the desert, I went high into the mountains, I went to the north, to the Rift Mountains, which is this sort of other mountain range that goes down to the Med Sea, and I hung out in villages. I went to this village where they just got electricity 2 months ago. I mean, it's insane, and the food is just so wonderful. And this book will hopefully really capture that essence, so I think you'll love it.
I can't wait.
Yeah, come back and talk to us when that happens, and maybe we'll catch up with you in London in the meantime.
Yeah.
Sign me up. Thank you so much, guys.
John Gregory Smith, and the book is Turkish Delights, and it is actually a delight. Thanks, John.
Oh, bless you. My pleasure. Thank you.
Well, I guess that does it.
Doesn't it just?
There you go. You're going to change up the game here.
We stayed in what some people call the Near East, some people call the Middle East for a whole program.
Yes.
We don't usually stay standing still that long.
No, but here we are.
So who knows where we might be next week. You'll have to join us in the same time, same place if you want to find out. So until then.
Bye-bye.